Hi, I'm your friend Claude, here with the outsider, Jamie, and this is episode 5 of the Nerd Bomber Podcast. So the last episode we did is obviously obscure superhero based, and to continue talking about superheroes because we just can't get enough, but to make it relevant to the time of year it is, being Black History Month, and the fact that Black Panther just came out and is getting a lot of hype as some people mistakenly calling it like the first black superhero in a mainstream movie or things along those lines. So we're going to discuss the history of Black superheroes on the screen well before Black Panther. Take it away.
All right, so we start off with, some of these characters are superheroes. Some of them are side characters. Their importance varies and their significance varies. And, you can decide for yourself whether or not it really means anything. The first one that I really found in sort of anything close to a mainstream superhero movie was Richard Pryor as Gus Gorman in Superman 3 from 1983. The part was played mostly for laughs. Of course, you're bringing in Richard Pryor, so that's kind of a given. So anybody who says this one doesn't count, I would probably be willing to acquiesce to that opinion.
As a superhero directly, probably not. Obviously. But superhero adjacent? Sure. Important in the context of a black character in a mainstream superhero movie? Absolutely. In that movie, though it's not one of the more amazing superhero / Superman films, his character was absolutely, I hesitate to say equally important, but on pretty even footing with the amount of screen time and importance as Superman in that movie.
Certainly in that individual movie, it was important to moving the narrative arc forward. He was an important character in the movie. Certainly as a superhero, he does not count, but his presence in a superhero movie at that time was, I don't want to call it an absolute first, because you could probably find some obscure, really obscure stuff from before that. But like I said, Superman at that time, you couldn't do much bigger and better than Superman on the widescreen. So I'd say that it counts in terms of representation.
Absolutely.
Moving on. The next one I think is a little bit more significant, actually. It's from Batman, 1989 Batman, the Tim Burton directed film, starring Michael Keaton, of course. In this movie, although the part in the movie is not big, it was really an attempt at something, and it was supposed to lead to something even more originally. And that was the part of Harvey Dent was played by Billy Dee Williams. Now, for those of you who might not know, of course, Harvey Dent is also Two-Face. Now, in the Batman movie, he was not Two-Face yet. But I think, as far as I know, the original plan was that that was going to be how they drove the plot forward in the next Batman movie, was to turn Harvey Dent into Two-Face, played by Billy Dee Williams. Of course, that just didn't work out. They ended up going with Danny DeVito's Penguin and Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman. So ultimately, it didn't mean much. His character in the movie is not super important, and the importance that it might have gained in the next movie never ended up happening. So I kind of chalk it up as an attempt, but ultimately probably you'd consider it a failure. His presence is still important, and you can see where they were going, but it just didn't work out.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like a prequel acting performance in a way. It's more notable for what it was supposed to be, right, what it didn't become, than what it is. But had that happened, that absolutely would have been incredibly major. He would have been the major villain in the movie.
Absolutely. And it's too bad. I really like Batman Returns the way it came out. Danny DeVito, Michelle Pfeiffer, like I said. But you kind of ended up wishing you could have seen what would have happened if it had gone in the other direction.
Right. Apparently, I'm just reading real quick in relation to the Billy Dee Williams thing. I guess a longtime rumor about that was that because he was supposed to end up being Two-Face, And they didn't go with him. He actually got paid for Batman Forever when they did use Two-Face, even though he didn't play it.
Wow.
But he's apparently since debunked that rumor.
Oh, okay.
He said that he only had a one-picture deal for Batman.
All right, so he wasn't sort of guaranteed that money. Okay. But I still, as far as I know, that was still the original plan. He might not have been contracted for it, but I think at the time they didn't really know. I don't know if they realized that they were going to make such a box office splash as they ended up making. So maybe they weren't confident enough to give everybody two-picture deals and all that.
Right. Well, one other tidbit of relevance to both this entry and the topic at large is that a similar rumor that actually is true, apparently Sean or Marlon, I think it was Marlon Wayans, was originally cast supposed to be Robin. And they ended up, he had a costume fitting and everything, and they ended up going with Chris O'Donnell, but they still paid him.
Huh. So that's very interesting.
And he obviously would have been a Black Robin. So
could have been and didn't.
Two interesting supposed to be black actors chosen for roles that didn't end up making the cut. It's not looking good over at Warner Brothers.
I guess not. So the next one that I have on my list is 1993, The Meteor Man. The Meteor Man. This movie's pretty significant. Ultimately, it ended up being a financial failure.
Right.
And it's played mostly for laughs, too. It's mostly a comedy. But this movie's important because not only does it have, you know, a black main character slash actor in the titular Meteor Man, otherwise known as, what is his character's name here? Jefferson Reed, played by Robert Townsend. So in addition to that, the cast is also, it features a lot of African-American actors right down the list. Eddie Griffin, Robert Guillaume, how do you pronounce that?
Guillaume?
Yeah. Okay. See, I find myself for the first time actually trying to say it out loud and like, right. Uh-oh, I'm realizing I'm not sure. James Earl Jones was in it, Bill Cosby, Sinbad, Naughty by Nature, Cypress Hill, Don Cheadle in an early role, Tommy Tiny Lister, Biz Markie, John Witherspoon. So this was a movie, and it was also the creative force behind it was the star, Robert Townsend, who actually wrote the screenplay and produced it and directed it. So he was pretty busy. So it's pretty significant in terms of like its overall creative team and in terms of behind the camera and in front of the camera. We're African-American in majority, but again, ultimately the movie didn't really work out financially and isn't really fondly remembered, I think, by most people.
I remember a lot of marketing for it when it came out. I actually, at the time, we both would have been in sixth grade. At the time, I thought the costume actually looked really awesome, but looking at it now, of course, it's rather silly and odd.
It might not have worked. Aged so well.
Well, see, I was a subscriber of Disney Adventures magazine in 1993, and they put Meteor Man on the cover of an issue, and that's, I think, how I first heard about it, and I remember just thinking it was really cool, and I think it's notable in the larger sense because basically the Meteor Man character is essentially like Superman power-wise.
Right.
But the movie itself is notable because he's not necessarily trying to save the entire world. It's actually like its issues deal with what were culturally kind of significant in the African American community at the time. He's actually just trying to save like the community he lives in and is a part of, like shutting down crack houses. I think they have him making peace between the Crips and the Bloods, like touching on the gang issues of the time.
Right.
Creating garden, like, actually it's weird because he creates a garden in the project, and now like in Detroit and like urban areas that have been kind of ruined, that's exactly what's happening on a large scale. They're kind of converting like parking lots and old demolished buildings into giant urban gardens. So, I don't know. It might be a stretch to say that this was sort of a predictor of the future or anything, but it's just cool to see how it, translates to real life all these years later.
I think there's also something to be said in terms of filmmaking and storytelling. If more superhero movies were willing to tell smaller stories like that, I think that
absolutely
a part of the fatigue that happens with superhero movies and action movies in general is that everything is about saving the entire world or the entire universe from ultimate evil. And this movie's success notwithstanding, it might be nice to see more stories that focus on more personal narratives on not such a grand scale.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's still kind of a big scale, but I think that's the beauty of a lot of these Netflix Marvel shows is that they can kind of take more time to do that. Like, you hear about the larger events from, like, the big screen movies, but their immediate world is dealing with, like, their life and how it affects their friends and family and everything.
That's a good point. And most of those Marvel Netflix shows have obviously been pretty high quality and pretty entertaining telling those stories.
Speaking of Marvel Netflix shows, I believe we have an entry on the list that is relevant to that. I don't know if this screws up your progression, but...
Well, I was going in chronological order, but go ahead.
The segue is too good to fucking...
Ruin it. Go ahead.
Well, how about this? We'll just we'll put a pin in that. We'll say pin that it. There is a relevant one coming up.
Oh, what a tease. First, of course, we have to cover such important cinematic achievements as 1994's Blank Man, starring Damon Wayans and David Alan Grier. They're both cast members of the Fox comedy show In Living Color, of course.
This was during that, I think, wasn't it?
Well, this came out in 94. I'm not sure about the air history of In Living Color.
I feel like it was still...
It might have been. It might have been. So this movie also played for laughs. It was basically a comedy, almost a parody satire, but important in the same ways that Meteor Man was, because it was a largely African-American creative element behind the film, behind the camera, and African-American presence in front of the camera.
Yeah, I remember this coming out. I don't think to this day I've ever actually seen it, other than maybe like a quick clip or something when I think maybe TBS was showing it at one point. My main memory of it as a kid was how clever I thought the fact that he used like dishwashing gloves for his superhero gloves was, and how it opened up the, you know, the low budget cosplay possibilities for me as a kid at that time.
It's funny, actually. My wife cosplayed as Rogue, and sort of the 1990s X-Men cartoon version of Rogue.
Right.
And she used yellow dishwashing gloves to pull off the glove look.
Perfect.
Absolutely.
Blank Man's legacy lives on.
And Blank Man at the time was not really well received by critics. And like I said, it's mostly played as a goofy comedy, so it's not really making a lot of deep social commentary, but just, you know, its representation on screen is still important, and it still marks sort of a point in time where this really wasn't happening, so...
Well, also, it's interesting to notice that, at least at the time, to get a black culture-focused superhero property on the screen, it had to be done in the form of a comedy.
And something recognizable, because at that time, the Wayans and the In Living Color and the personalities involved and the type of comedy, you know, sort of being marketed was very familiar and very successful.
Absolutely.
So we're moving on. So we go by a few years here. We come to 1997, and there's a few in 1997. We'll start with sort of the most unfortunate. The Shaquille O'Neal vehicle, Steel.
Ah, yes.
Steel / John Henry Irons. The amazingly named John Henry Irons, starring none other than Shaquille O'Neal. This movie was pretty much a failure in every possible way, but it still counts given the criteria of what we're discussing.
Well, I mean, Steel is from the story arc from the Superman comics, immediately following the death of Superman, leading up to Superman's return. There are four kind of different alternate Supermen that they kind of want readers to guess which one of these is the real Superman kind of thing. And Steel was one of them in the comics. And I guess it was well known at the time that Shaq was a pretty massive Superman fan. He has like a tattoo on his arm.
He does indeed.
He talked about it in a lot of interviews. So at the time, I think it seemed kind of like obvious casting, because Steel, the comic character, is an African-American character to, you know, embody that on the big screen. Shaq is kind of fits the way he was depicted in the comics, and obviously being a fan was clearly going to jump at the chance.
In 1997 was sort of peak Shaq.
Yeah. Yeah, Shaq Fu was around then, right?
Shaq Fu, you know, his sneaker. Had he already done Kazam by then? I'm not really sure.
Not that year, then the next year, yeah.
Just for the record, this movie was made on a $16 million budget and still fell well short of making its money back.
Ouch.
1.7 is its box office.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Did, I don't know. The, if you look at the comic character, the way that they drew him, the costume and everything, the physical representation of that they came up with in the movie falls very far short of that. And I'm not saying that if they had done a faithful version, it would have saved the movie, but it's surely one of many reasons why people maybe were turned off. But it definitely is clumsy looking.
Good visuals can save a bad movie. They can at least make things watchable and entertaining, and this kind of failed in every basic way.
Sure.
But again, it still counts in terms of what we're talking about. But maybe the least said about Steel, the better. Let's move on to one that's a little bit more important, actually, and one that we discussed last week. It was on my list of favorite obscure comic book movies, even though the character is not obscure, and most people probably remember it. 1997, Spawn. This movie is about the character Spawn, otherwise known as Al Simmons, and played by Michael Jai White. Of course, this is an African-American character, an African-American lead role, in a really, at the time, again, easy to forget now, at the time was a very sort of visible franchise and character in pop culture and comics especially, was the character Spawn. And this was sort of a big budget Hollywood attempt at doing that. And ultimately, I don't think it really worked out financially at the time, but I think it's a little bit more well-remembered than some of the other things we've mentioned so far.
It's also, I mean, we didn't maybe touch on this the last time, and I don't know the history intimately about what led to this, but it's also fairly interesting to note that, or how fast anyway, that the character of Spawn, which was from its inception an African-American character, how fast it was able to go from conception to major comic publication to major feature film. We're talking 5 years.
It's a very quick turnaround for that sort of thing. You know, Superman and Batman were around for decades and decades before they got their turn.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's... that. I feel the need to justify that by saying that there's... obviously, the climate for that should never have existed. It shouldn't have been a challenge to get an African-American character, and you know, whatever. But
right.
Because it was, and because the climate, you know, didn't have a lot of that for a long time, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, and like I said, I like the movie. I think it's pretty well pulled off. It does have a shortcoming in terms of what we're talking about here, which is representation. So you have this story and this character that's an African-American character and is brought to the big screen and played as such. Unfortunately, they did something with another character and went the exact opposite way. Throughout the series and the comic, one of the primary antagonists is a character named Jason Wynn. And in the comics, and also in the HBO, the very successful and very well thought of HBO animated series Spawn, he is African American. In the movie, they decided to cast, as I mentioned last time, Martin Sheen.
Right.
Which kind of turned it around a little bit, and I don't think it totally soils the legacy of a movie like this representing African-Americans on screen in a superhero movie, but it does kind of do a little bit of damage to its own legacy in that area by pulling that off. So I don't know if that tarnishes the legacy or if it's just sort of an oddity in casting that you sort of move past.
Are you saying that there's a black mark on the legacy of Spawn?
No. As a matter of fact, you're saying that. Thank you very much.
All right. Moving on.
All right. So the next one's kind of a big deal. Now, this one, it's not really a superhero movie, but it is definitely a comic book movie. And actually, I'm surprised it didn't at least get a quick mention last week when we were talking about comic book movies, even though it was the furthest thing from obscure at the time and remains as such. 1997, again, the third entry from that year, Men in Black.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Agent J, of course, played by Will Smith. And really the lead role. I mean, I guess he and Tommy Lee Jones at the time kind of share top billing in that movie, both in terms of their names and their characters. But certainly an important presence and an important starring role for Will Smith. And again, representing African-American character in a comic book movie.
Right. I think it's easy to forget for people that you know, don't already know or weren't aware of at the time, it's easy to forget that that has comic book origins. It's, I believe it wasn't produced by any of the major publishers at the time. Like,
I'm not sure of its publishing background in print.
I honestly didn't hear about it until after the movie came out. Like, again, I said in the last episode, I was a big fan of Wizard magazine. They covered all that comics to do in the heyday in the 90s. And even in there, I didn't see them talk about it until it was after the movie came out.
Right. I would have had no idea at the time that that was a comic book property. I think a very, very high percentage of people who would have seen it would have known it primarily and in many cases exclusively from the films.
For sure, and probably to this day.
Okay, so the next one on the list I think is one of the most significant ones. 1998's Blade, starring Wesley Snipes. It's not forgotten, but I think it's definitely one of the higher quality movies that we've discussed so far. Men in Black, of course, a huge hit. Blade, again, Wesley Snipes, African-American actor in a lead role, and also has some other important African-American representation on screen, including the female lead is a character named Dr. Karen Jansen, who gets bit by a vampire, gets rescued by Blade, but is not really a damsel in distress. She does a lot of her own thing. She's a very independent, very strong character, played by N. Bush Wright. And also featured is Sanaa Lathan as Vanessa Brooks, who is Blade's biological mother, Blade's given name being Eric Brooks. So this is, I think, one of the more important entries on this list that we have in terms of the foundation of African-Americans in superhero movies. One of the reasons being that it was really successful considering it was kind of an out-of-the-blue property. It's interesting that Blade is really Marvel's, it's not their very first attempt at a big screen hero, but it's definitely the one that set the foundation for superhero movies going forward, and I think it doesn't always get the credit it deserves for that.
Yeah, it's weird. It ticks all the boxes for the criteria that you look for in these categories, and even though it's to me, and I as far as I can tell, it in the hearts and minds of the average person, it's the go-to choice for, you know, when you think of superhero movies that have starred black actors before Black Panther, as the first one anybody I know even comes up with. Duh, Blade.
Of course. It's kind of the thing people are saying, hey, what about Blade?
Yeah. It certainly wasn't something people weren't aware of at the time. And there were three of them. But yeah.
Yeah, and then the sequel, Blade 2, also has some good, some pretty decent representation on screen. Of course, you have Blade again. No more N. Bush Wright, no more Sanaa Lathan, but you do have, you know, some other African-American characters. You even have Donnie Yen as an Asian character, as the Snowman, which is the only name they give him. I'm looking at the information right now, and so the movie also features an actor named Danny John Jules, who's, I don't know him from really much else, but he's another African-American character, and he's actually responsible for recruiting Blade into the Blood Pack, which is, of course, the group of vampires who are being trained to hunt and kill Blade, but they need to join forces to fight this other greater threat. So both of those movies have some good representation on screen, but of course Blade is the centerpiece of that, and again, a very important, maybe one of the most important foundational blocks in terms of having a little bit of diversity on screen, specifically as it relates to superhero movies. All right, so we skip a couple years ahead. And now Blade also, like I said, I always had the sequels, so we kind of jump around year-wise. But Blade, the original, came out in 98. In 2000, we had X-Men.
Which we, I believe, went to see together.
We did. We went to see that, not opening night, but one of the first weeks that it was out. Now, this movie, of course, there's not a ton of diversity. I mean, there's basically one character that I can think of offhand, and anything else would be secondary or tertiary to the story. The important one, though, is Storm, Aurora Monroe, played by Halle Berry. The character would later be played by Alexandra Shipp in X-Men Age of Apocalypse. I think that's the one. Yeah. So the X-Men movie has her in a pretty important role, pretty central. And X-Men in general lends itself well to this. The whole point of X-Men is it's an analog for diversity commentary, and that's the way it was written when it was created. Stan Lee used it as an analog for that sort, those sorts of conversations with the mutants. Instead of it being about race or religion, it was about mutants being persecuted. So it's no surprise that the X-Men would feature a little bit of diversity in their cast. Of course, in later movies, you'd see a little bit more, although, again, they don't tend to be primary characters. You'd have Will.i.am turn up in the much maligned X-Men Wolverine Origins story. And also you have the character of Bishop, played by Omar Sy, turn up in the one of the better X-Men movies, in my opinion, X-Men Days of Future Past.
I guess I'm going to rain on the parade, in a sense, here with this entry. Because Halle Berry's casting as Storm always seemed to me like one of the, I don't want to say one of the worst aspects of the X-Men movies, but it was disappointing. Just, I guess not on paper, although I guess being such a fan of the cartoon as I was, I wanted somebody who seemed a little more like that, seemed a little more to fit that, unfortunately, probably stereotype casting. You know, the accent that Storm had in the cartoon, and just she seemed more regal and more in control of her powers. Halle Berry kind of, you don't, she was just honestly came off more like decoration in a scene than she did the powerful Storm that was a commanding presence in other media before this. And it's not entirely her fault. I feel like there wasn't a ton of really good Storm dialogue or, you know, really great stuff for her to do. She came, you know, she used her powers in pivotal moments. Unfortunately, she did have a pretty oft-quoted terrible line in, like, the climax of the movie when the character Toad is, you know, he's a villainous character, and they're fighting him, and she gets to take him on, and he has a frog-like tongue, and she asks him, do you know what happens to a toad when it gets struck by lightning or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep. Yeah,
and what is the answer?
The same thing that happens to everything else.
Right, and then she fries the shit out of him.
I think that part of the complaints that you're giving, though, is maybe a complaint that could be laid upon the X-Men franchise in general,
yeah,
which is kind of a sterilization of the characters and a depowering of the characters. And that's one thing that you run into trouble with comic books, too, I think, in general, in terms of trying to tell the story on screen. You know, you have these characters that have these powers that are makes them not omnipotent, but almost untouchable. I mean, her ability to control the weather in the comics and even in the cartoon makes her quite a force to be reckoned with. And
for sure,
I think the writers kind of, I'm not saying that you have to do it, but I think the writers struggle to find a way to deaden that a little bit so that the bad guy doesn't have to contend with that, because then you'd have to upscale the bad guy's abilities. And
right,
it's one of the reasons why, actually, in most of the X-Men movies, Professor Charles Xavier is immediately written out of the story. He's incapacitated in some way. He's in a coma. He's injured. He's not there.
That's a great point.
Because his abilities would basically end any conflict almost immediately.
Right.
And they have to find a way to get around that.
Yeah, I mean, she's, in the cartoon, shown to be basically equally powerful as Magneto. Can neutralize him.
And in the DC Comics crossover, she defeats none other than Wonder Woman.
Uh-oh.
In single combat.
How would that go in today's very Wonder Woman heavy environment?
I'm just saying, it happened. So we'll move on. The next entry is also a little bit unfortunate and also features Halle Berry. It's 2004's Catwoman, where she plays Catwoman, but she doesn't play Selina Kyle. No. She plays Patience Phillips.
Yeah, who? was that... That character, that alter ego character, was created for this movie, right? That's not something from the comics, was it? I don't know what the modern, at the time, modern incarnation of Catwoman.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's a comic background to the character of Patience Phillips. It might have been inspired by something in the comics, which is often is, but in my familiarity with the comics doesn't extend to a character named Patience Phillips being Catwoman, I will say that.
Right.
And the character doesn't seem to have her own Wikipedia page anyway, so that would lead me to believe that maybe she doesn't really have an existence in the comic book narrative.
Ah, fair enough.
So that, I mean, that's really about all I can say about this movie.
Or all you'd want to say.
She's African-American. It existed. Good for her. Good for the filmmakers for getting it made. But the movie's just not very good, and it's not very well remembered. And I think that that's probably for the best.
No disagreement here.
So we'll move on to bigger and better things. The next one is an interesting entry, and I don't know if you might have seen this on the list that I previewed to you, but I'm going to go to 2004 again, another movie. This time it's The Incredibles. It's Samuel L. Jackson in his first of what will be a few different appearances on this list as Frozone/Lucius Best. You know, he's a character. He's a secondary, maybe even tertiary character. He's not super important to the narrative. You could unplug him and plug in a lot of other generic superhero characters, and it would be just fine. But he's a entertaining character. He had some good scenes, good dialogue that people really remember. Where's my super suit?
Right.
And again, it shows a little bit of representation in a Pixar movie, which has not been Pixar's strongest suit up to that point. They've recently sort of deepened their well a little bit. But at that point, it was pretty important, and he's a good character, and it's a good movie.
Yeah, it's a fantastic movie. Which is still mind-boggling to this day that this came out in 2004, and any number, and probably all of the other Pixar properties, virtually, have gotten sequels. And then the sequel to this, what, doesn't come out until next year?
There are three Cars movies.
Yeah. Do you think Cars warrants three movies? I don't
know.
No. I personally do not. I thought The Incredibles was... Sorry. Incredible. And there absolutely should have been a sequel much sooner. Hopefully we'll see Frozone return for this one as well.
I hope so. I think that's the intention, I would say. So we'll go on from there. The next one is a really interesting entry. I watched the movie once. It's a very unique movie. I don't know if you have any commentary on it or what your thoughts are on this movie, because we've never really discussed it. It's a 2008 film called Hancock, and Will Smith makes his second appearance on the list. And I'll leave it there, because I'm just curious what you think about this movie, if you have any opinions or not.
I have seen it. I really like the concept. And I thought it was a mostly pretty decent movie. I thought the effects were mostly pretty well done. I think it explores an angle or a point of view on the concept of superheroes that I don't think had previously been done, at least not on this level before. I mean, there was a little bit touched on in the previously mentioned Superman 3. When Superman becomes kind of the evil version of himself, thanks to the Richard Pryor character, and, you know, kind of behaves similarly to Hancock in this movie, if not worse.
Right.
But other than that, I mean, I think it's nice that, you know, again, in a perfect world, this wouldn't be the case, but it's nice that they gave such a unique story idea to an African-American starring role that also was just a really unique and interesting angle on superhero stories.
And again, it wasn't a recognizable franchise. It didn't come from anywhere. Nobody saw it coming. I don't think anybody had any knowledge of what it was before it was right there in front of them. And even as you watch it, it kind of takes an interesting twist towards the end of the movie that I didn't see coming. So yeah, it was very interesting, a different kind of concept. And again, I kind of give kudos to the filmmakers for being able to pitch this and get it made. And it's, you know, the way the vibe of the movie and the spirit of the movie is so kind of just a little bit outside the box. It makes me think that they were able to sort of put their creative vision forward on their own terms for the most part, which is just interesting because it is kind of so weird and offbeat.
Yeah, you could almost envision whatever executive was assigned to this project sort of just judging it on face value and kind of going, yeah, do you guys do what you're going to do, and not really paying attention because, yeah, it doesn't seem
Will
like
Smith.
It was, right. Well, it's like, oh, we've got Will Smith. We trust him. You guys do make your little wacky superhero movie.
On a $150 million budget.
Yeah, well, that's the power of Will Smith. It doesn't seem micromanaged in the way that almost any other Hollywood movie does. It's their style of, like, filmmaking by committee and, you know, oh, did it test well with this demographic? Well, we got to amp this aspect of it up and, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a very refreshing kind of a unique movie in the overall superhero genre?
A couple things that it does, just to keep on it for a minute, a couple things that it does interestingly and a little bit uniquely, at least at the time. In the early parts of the movie, you know, you don't really get to know Hancock very well. And he's kind of presented as this, he's almost like a force of nature. You don't really know him as a character. You kind of see him from a distance. You see what he's done. You see some of the after, the consequences of what he's done. I just think it's interesting. There's a comic series called Marvels, illustrated by Alex Ross. And it's all these superhero stories told from the vantage point of, mostly it's this reporter, but I mean, it could be from the vantage point of citizens on the street. You know, it's Spider-Man and the Green Goblin fighting, but as you watch it from the sidewalk and all these different things. And it's kind of interesting that at least in the early parts of the movies, you see Hancock in some cases from a distance.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting way to show a superhero movie. Instead of being right on top of it, you kind of see like, you know, it's like, well, I've already said it three times. I don't mean to be redundant, but it's from a distance. And I just think it was, it was unique. It was uniquely presented at least early on in the movie before he really, you get to know his character and you get a little character development when that changes a little bit.
Yeah. Guess almost every level of the approach to making this movie was like just off of, you know, the typical expected path.
I guess I really need to watch it again. That's kind of what I'm learning in this little conversation. So,
yeah, you're making it sound like, that sounds really cool.
This movie sounds all right.
I've seen it once. Let's check it out.
So we'll go on. And here we start to get into the really super mainstream stuff, especially in our modern sort of, you know, the landscape of modern filmmaking. We come to 2008. We come to the beginnings of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Iron Man. In Iron Man, there's a character named James Rhodes. He's, of course, War Machine. He's not War Machine in the first movie. He becomes War Machine. In 2008's Iron Man, he's played by Terrence Howard. And then after that, subsequently, in the other Iron Man movies and in the Avengers movies that he's appeared in, he has been played by Don Cheadle. And, of course, his importance to the story is he's really central to the story in a lot of cases, at least in his relationship to Tony Stark. And so he's a pretty important character that you couldn't just unplug and plug anybody else back in. I think that's what makes him kind of gives him a little bit of leg up of some of the other, at least some of the other side characters that we've discussed. And we can get into him more in a minute, but just to finish the point, at the end of the movies, the end of the 2008 Iron Man movie is the first sort of Avengers post-credit scene and features Samuel L. Jackson making his second appearance on the list in his first appearance as Nick Fury.
Yeah, when I used to watch the Iron Man cartoon, I guess it was from 94, and I actually liked War Machine better than Iron Man on the cartoon. So I was pretty excited to see War Machine finally kind of be a big screen in a movie and everything.
Of course, they made you wait in that first movie. They just hinted at it and didn't give it to you.
Yeah, I just from his secret identity, I guess, alter ego perspective, I actually wasn't a fan of the casting of either Terrence Howard or Don Cheadle. I think Don Cheadle is superior to Terrence Howard because Terrence Howard kind of comes off almost bland, I guess, for me. Don Cheadle has a personality, but it just doesn't seem right. I don't buy him as a military man. I don't buy him as like the character, like kind of a, you know, I guess as strong of a presence. He seems too laid back.
Yeah, and he has a little bit of a goofy vibe going.
Yeah, he's more Ocean's 11 to me than, than Iron Man.
Yeah, yeah, buying him as a military man is a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like. I like the way they've done War Machine in terms of the War Machine, the suit, the character, you know. So I think that it's been pretty well done. And like I said, you mentioned the 90s cartoon. I thought you were going to talk about Nick Fury really not being known as an African-American character before 2008.
Oh, yeah.
Now, of course, he's known. I mean, Samuel L. Jackson, Nick Fury, that's just, it's kind of ubiquitous. I mean, everybody just sees him that way at this point. But before that, Nick Fury was a Caucasian guy. I mean, he went back to like the war days. He had sort of a less powerful version of Captain America's super soldier serum to stay young and all that sort of thing. And it was actually played in a 90s made-for-TV movie by none other than David Hasselhoff.
Which I will go to bat for in terms of physical appearance.
He did. He totally pulled it off. If you look at Nick Fury, the way he was drawn in the 70s and 80s, and you look at David Hasselhoff as Nick Fury, it's pretty damn good.
I'm not going to paint Hasselhoff as some sort of acting god or anything like that. you know, solid, entertaining TV presence over the decades. Mm-hmm. But clearly, he's no Academy Award winner. However, that the fact that he embodied it physically so well made it, you know, acceptable for me. But also, and if I'm going to be consistent here, initially, I was pretty annoyed with Samuel L. Jackson's casting as Nick Fury, because it takes a character that's established and kind of turns it into something that it's not. But also because at that point, and even after that point, culturally, Samuel L. Jackson was overexposed. It was just, you know, he was everywhere.
Motherfucking snakes on motherfucking planes.
Exactly.
It is true. I mean, he's rarely met a role he didn't like or something he didn't say yes to. It would seem. I mean, I don't know how many scripts he's getting compared to how many he's doing, but he does do a lot, and he has continued to do a lot over the years. I will say, just in case anybody doesn't realize, you know, the African-American version of Nick Fury was, I think, first presented in the Ultimates, Marvel mm-hmm. Ultimates line, which is kind of, you know, just slight retellings of basically the origin stories of, I guess, the Avengers characters. I don't know how far beyond into other characters that line of comics went, but at least that version of Nick Fury is sort of based on that. And interestingly, mm-hmm. I have a book of sort of Marvel artwork. It's actually Marvel paintings done by Julie Bell and Boris Vallejo. And one of them is a painting of Nick Fury, and it looks very much like Samuel L. Jackson. And it was done long before the movie was ever made.
Well, they actually did make a conscious effort to make him, to draw him to sort of look like that, even in the comics, to sort of, I guess, as like a fantasy casting angle on their end. And it just happened to work out that they actually did get him for that. So that was done purposefully.
Also in that book features a painting of Charles Xavier looking very much like Bruce Willis. Mm-hmm. I think we can all be happy that did not happen.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly which one you're talking about. Yeah. Huh. Yeah, definitely. I will say, though, just to you know, not shit on Sammy L here, though I was initially annoyed, the way they present the character is different from the classic Nick Fury and his Howling Commandos portrayal. So in that sense, and the way he's used, he's won me over.
Yeah, I mean, he might not match the character if that had been the character, but he matches the character the way it's written.
Right.
Probably for him, so it's probably a reason for that. So we stay in the Marvel Cinematics Universe. In 2014, Captain America the Winter Soldier came out, and that was the first to feature Falcon / Sam Wilson, played by Anthony Mackie. Falcon's very important in the comics. He's been around for a long time. He's been an important friend of Captain America for a long time, and he even, in the comics, took the mantle of Captain America for a while. So he's an important character in the comics. He's an important character in the movies. I like Anthony Mackie. I like the way the character is portrayed. I could stand to see more of him, actually. But so far, so good. And then we'll see what becomes of it from here on.
Yeah. I actually have very much enjoyed the casting and portrayal and usage of the actor and this character in all of his appearances.
I was just going to say, I like the relationships they're developing with him and Bucky and Cap.
Yeah.
And even, you know, T'Challa, Black Panther, that we'll get to later. They had some good moments in Civil War, which was a good movie, if a little flawed. And I hope that they continue to build on some of that.
Well, it's interesting that you kind of point out the relationship between all those characters. Because evidently, that relationship between the real-life actors is a big reason why Anthony Mackie has actually kind of, I don't know if he's turned it down, but he's not necessarily stoked about the idea of doing a solo Falcon movie. I guess it's come up, and he basically cited that he enjoys the group dynamic, and he, if they're not going to be there, then he's not as interested in it. So I thought that was interesting.
I hadn't heard that, but that is pretty interesting. So we're going to stay in 2014. Unfortunately, we're going to take a step down in quality, at least in my opinion. We're going to talk about Amazing Spider-Man 2. In this movie, the primary antagonist is played by Jamie Foxx. He plays Electro / Max Dillon. This is a movie that is really strange because, in my opinion, Oh, and I'm sure we'll talk more about Electro in a second, but I'm going to start talking about Spider-Man here. In my opinion, Amazing Spider-Man 2 really pulls off the look of Spider-Man, at least like a certain version of Spider-Man. And it's like, it looks like it's directly off the comics page.
Agreed.
Which is usually something that is to be celebrated, because so many superheroes have been a long way from looking like the way they were drawn and presented on in print.
Right.
However, the movie just isn't very good. Superhero Spider-Man looks great, and the villains are all pretty much garbage.
Well, I mean, contrast how accurately they captured the look of Spider-Man in that movie with the complete opposite dynamic for the character of Electro. I mean, sure, there's an argument to be made about the comic book, the classic comic book costume for the character Electro being a little goofy and a little maybe difficult to pull off directly on screen, but this doesn't even attempt it even in the slightest. Not even color scheme, nothing.
No, you didn't even hint at it. I mean, he's just a glowing blue person. I don't even know where to go with it. I mean, I don't know what they were thinking. And you know, it's a movie that suffers from, you know, I don't like to bash on CGI too much. I usually am okay with it. You have sort of more frequent complaints about the use of CGI. But if you're trying to pull off a shot and you can't pull it off in the real world, so you want to go to CGI. If you also can't pull it off in CGI, then find a different shot.
Right.
I mean, the scene that's supposed to be this big dramatic scene, it was shown in the trailers and the teasers, and he's flipping, and he's got his webs out, and he's dodging electrical bolts, and he's all between these sort of power transformers. It just looks like it's 100% computer animated, and it's not supposed to look that way.
Right.
But a movie can survive bad CGI if it's good. This movie isn't really otherwise good, so it just adds to the sort of pile-on.
I will say that Jamie Foxx as an actor has developed into being pretty damn good. This nobody's gonna point to this movie as a typical example of that, or as any kind of like version of his best work by any stretch. But in the portrayal of this character leading up to his transformation into Electro, I thought he did a really good job handling the emotional aspect of it. And I wasn't totally turned off to the possibility of him playing the character based on that. But like you said, the handling of the actual character once he becomes Electro is just so bad that it just kind of ruins anything even remotely, you know, complimentary about it before that.
Yeah, I think so. All right, so we'll go back to the Marvel Cinematics Universe now, even though we're going to be talking about TV. This is 2015. Netflix series Jessica Jones gives us our introduction to Luke Cage.
Luke Cage. That's not his. That has nothing to do with. Just
nobody's
like
ever right said there. It like that. Nobody says it like that. That's really not a thing.
I'm gonna make it a thing.
So he's played by Mike Coulter. I really, really liked him in Jessica Jones. I really like Jessica Jones as a series. I think it's the best of the Marvel Netflix series, in my opinion.
Agreed.
I really like him as Luke Cage in that show as well. And I really like him as Luke Cage in the first half of the Luke Cage show. The second half, of the last third maybe of the Luke Cage series, goes a little awry, in my opinion. It kind of takes some weird turns. It's not really, it doesn't have anything to do with Mike Coulter. It doesn't have anything to do with the Luke Cage character. Some other strange decisions are made, and I'm not going to spoil them or get into them too much right now. But that's kind of a narrative problem. The presentation of Luke Cage, I think, has been very well handled, and I like the character and I like Mike Coulter.
Okay. I pretty much feel the exact same way. I except for the part about the Luke Cage series, as I have not yet seen it, and I'm not entirely sure that I will. Maybe at some point, but it's not a priority. I don't know why. It just seemed less exciting than all the other options at the time. Yeah, I think he does a great job. I think the character is great. The only thing is I wish they would give, and hopefully maybe, I don't know, they're building to this at some point, but one of the popular kind of sticking points for me with superhero properties is I want to see some form of a recognizable costume at some point. I get, you know, they're taking a kind of a DIY kind of low-lying approach where he's kind of trying to stay from making too much of a public spectacle of himself, but I mean, he's part of the Defenders. They made a, you know, Defenders TV show.
Yeah.
The TV version of the Avengers, if you will. I mean, it, obviously they're a separate group in the canon of the comic books. But it's a group of these superheroes that they have established on their own series, and now they brought them together. And it's the same thing with Jessica Jones. I mean, I know the whole character is predicated upon the idea that she resents any kind of involvement with being an official superhero. But at least give us a flashback scene.
They have hinted at it a little bit. I think you get a couple quick shots of the old costume, I think. The white, I think it's white and navy blue. I think they do give you hints of that, but they certainly never show it.
Wasn't there one where he had, I mean, I guess I thought that's what the t-shirt was. Because didn't he have a yellow version too?
Well, with him, I'm talking about Jessica Jones.
They
hint at her costume. Now, there is a scene where he's, it's like the leftover components of something that he was sort of strapped to when he first got his powers. So it looks like he's got the cuffs and the thing on his head and the yellow shirt. And that's kind of the problem with trying to recreate the costume he's best known for from the 70s. Is barely a superhero costume at all. It's like, you know, slacks and a loose shirt with these arm cuffs and this thing on his head. So it's hard to pull that off, but you can find a way to sort of hint at that
without
making him look ridiculous. I think that it's been shown that that's possible.
Right. Put a suit on, use the colors, something. I mean, you can put wrist cuffs that are cooler or, you know, more purposeful.
The only problem with putting a suit on Luke Cage, they kind of hinted at it when he wears regular clothes.
Yeah.
There's nothing that the suit can provide that his body can't better provide.
It provides identification, damn it.
I guess. It gives your friend Claude what he really wants. Anyway, I think Luke Cage has been really good for representation, actually. And we should talk about the actual series, Luke Cage, too. Despite the fact that I think the narrative goes a little bit off on the last third, it does focus. It has an almost entirely African-American cast. It focuses on those issues, focuses on that setting. And again, that's really important for representation because it's not done as a niche show for a niche audience. It's done for a general audience, but still shows that life.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe it's a niche experience in a way in terms of, like, you know, the mass audience doesn't have that that same life experience that's depicted in, like, inner city Harlem. But it's absolutely done in a way that it is understandable for anybody's point of view.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'm gonna I know I've been going chronologically here. I'm gonna skip around because I want to save one of these entries that goes into our. It goes into a different conversation. So I'm going to skip to 2018, which is obviously this year. I'm not going to talk about the thing that you think I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about a TV show. It's a CW show, I believe, called Black Lightning. Black Lightning is a superhero from DC Comics. His name is Jefferson Pierce, and he's played by Cress Williams. Again, Black Lightning, similar to Luke Cage, is important because it features a majority African-American cast. And that's what you see on screen, which is important in representation, as you've been talking about so far. So, and also that's a, I mean, the CW isn't really a major network, but it's on a broadcast channel, and it's not a streaming channel. So it's pretty significant in terms of the evolution of what we're talking about.
Yeah, have you seen any of it?
No, I have not.
I have not either. I probably should give it a chance, but
likewise.
I was just so turned off by the very, very clumsy handling of his appearance and his costume. And I just felt like the character deserved better. And the idea of, you know, making another starring vehicle for an African-American superhero deserves better than what looks fairly low budget and clumsy, especially when compared with DC's other superhero series on the same network. As far as within the TV framework, their budgets seem to be whatever it takes to get the job done. And I don't know, he's just not making the character of Black Lightning, the way they're executing him, is not giving the best first impression.
Yeah, I will say the visuals of the costume kind of turned me off from wanting to watch it. Now, the other thing is, I watch too much TV as it is. It's really hard to keep up with all this stuff, especially with the CW's DC TV universe. There's so much to keep track of. I've been watching Supergirl since the beginning. I haven't been watching Arrow. I haven't been watching Flash. I haven't been watching Legends of Tomorrow. Now you have Black Lightning. Who knows if they're all going to cross over with Black Lightning? I don't know. But it is a lot. It's very sort of daunting to try to take all that on. But I should give it a chance. It's also significant. The show is also significant. It's getting credit for not just being a superhero show, but also, again, the representation on screen of diversity, but also that the storylines are not all, it's not all superhero stuff necessarily. There's a lot of real world plots. While there are, you know, villains and superhero stuff happening, there's also a lot of character development. This is according to the things that I've seen. Its reception has been very positive. And also, just to add to the diversity and the intersectionalism of, you know, sort of social movements, it also features a definitely the first black lesbian superhero in TV history, and probably one of the only ones in comic book history and the history of superheroes. So it goes beyond just African American, and it goes a little bit further than that to LGBTQ plus. And so that's also pretty important, because intersectionalism is a very important part of social progress.
The Black Lightning series also, maybe to help entice us to checking it out. I just saw that it, playing his father figure and oldest friend, a character named, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. It's it looks like either Gambi or Jambi, G-A-M-B-I.
Okay.
Played by James Remar, that we mentioned in the last episode.
From the Phantom fame.
Right. Everything I've been seeing actually has been giving it decent reviews. And it's, again, it's not for lack of the subject matter appealing to me. But yeah, I guess one of these days I'm going to sit down and have a Black Lightning Luke Cage marathon.
The Luke Cage one, I would definitely suggest. I know that I said that sort of the storyline goes a little bit awry in the last third, but I think it's worth watching.
Sure.
All right, so we're going to come to kind of the crux of the matter and why this conversation comes up. It is basically the character of Black Panther. Black Panther, otherwise known as T'Challa, was originally introduced on screen in 2016's Captain America Civil War, played, of course, by Chadwick Boseman. He had a much hyped appearance in that movie. People were really looking forward to it. Got big pops, you know, Comic-Con trailers and things like that. And then when the movie came out, it was pretty well liked. I don't think it's as good as Captain America Civil Winter Soldier, but it's a pretty good movie. And his appearance was definitely something that was highlighted. Although a lot of people at the time were talking about how he steals the movie, I actually think that movie does a good job of not letting any one character steal it, which I think is actually to the movie's benefit. Every character gets kind of their role and their part, and they're all important.
For sure. I think that's one of the things that makes it so good.
So Black Panther, that character was introduced in 2016's Captain America: The Civil War. And of course, recently released, I think released officially last, Thursday night, going into the President's Day weekend, was the film Black Panther. So the movie has a, like I said, the cast, the creative forces behind the movie are pretty, you know, majority African-American. Again, I shouldn't say African-American, of African descent. You have Chadwick Boseman playing T'Challa, Michael B. Jordan playing Eric Killmonger Stevens. And I know that you had mentioned off before we started recording that one of the things that we left off our list was actually an appearance by Michael B. Jordan as Johnny Storm in the Fantastic Four movie that Fox made a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it's another example of, you know, a traditionally Caucasian character being cast in a modern movie incarnation to be played by somebody of a different race or ethnic background. Generally, I'm not for that stuff. I actually still haven't seen this movie, but I will say that Michael B. Jordan's role in this movie as Johnny Storm is one of the only things that is universally praised about it. Pretty much the rest of the movie is trashed almost across the board, but
it's one of the very few superhero movies that I've never been motivated to watch.
I've been motivated to run from it.
That's exactly right.
But yeah, Michael B. Jordan is praised for his consistent charisma and enjoyable screen presence, and sometimes called the only thing likable in the movie.
Well, maybe I'll give it a chance just for that. So, moving on with the cast, it also features, in an important role, Daniel Kaluuya, which is, he's now well known for having appeared in Get Out, which is a movie that Jordan Peele put together, kind of a sleeper hit, and a really good movie. I really enjoyed that movie, actually.
So, Get Out is, obviously, relevant to the broader topic here, because it's significant in that Jordan Peele is also an African American actor, director, performer. And Get Out was actually, it had 4 Academy Award nominations, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Actor for Mr. Daniel Kaluuya. And Jordan Peele is actually only the 3rd person after James L. Brooks and Warren Beatty to earn those nominations for a debut film.
It's crazy because Jordan Peele now gets listed as like director of Get Out. Right. Instead of former star of Mad TV, which is right. or Key and Peele. It's just hard to believe that he came from that, and now look what he's done. It's kind of amazing.
That's what I saw Key and Peele when it first came out. Oh, that's Mad TV. That's what they're doing now.
Yeah, Key and Peele was really good.
Impressive.
So just moving on with the cast. Letitia Wright, Winston Duke, Angela Bassett, Forrest Whitaker. So, you know, it's got a very... It also happens to have Martin Freeman and Andy Serkis, and they are 2 Caucasian men. But, yeah, it's got a very strong African cast. And by all accounts, you know, the production design, the costumes, everything is... A lot of thought's been put into these things. So, but like I said, I haven't seen it yet. I'm really excited to see it. And so I'm hoping that it lives up to all this hype, because it's really important in terms of, for a few different reasons. One, sort of like, it's important for the basic reason that it's, you know, moving the narrative forward for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But obviously, the more important thing is its social importance in terms of presenting what it's presenting on screen. So I'm looking forward to seeing it for those reasons, obviously.
So on the episode prior to this, we heard Cousin Adam's assessment of the movie. You will no doubt bring yours once you see it. And honestly, I had not planned to go to the theater to see Black Panther. I was going to wait till it came out on video or Netflix or something, or, you know, probably to rent it. I may change that now, so perhaps we'll have my thoughts sooner as well.
Very good. So, you know, before we sort of wrap up what we're talking about here, I just think that there's a few other things I just wanted to mention in terms of movie making on screen. These movies don't really count in terms of superhero movies. I mean, some of these might have comic book origins. I'm not really sure about all of them, but some of them we know don't. Others I'm not so sure of. But I just thought they were worth mentioning. So I'm just going to go right down the list, and then if you want to backtrack and pick it up anywhere and talk about any of them individually or specifically, then... I'll give you the floor, and then I'll comment as I see fit. Mace Windu, 1999, Star Wars Episode I, played by, again, Samuel L. Jackson. One of the first really, well, you have Lando, of course, but, you know, he was pretty significant as a Jedi character. 1973, TV show Shaft. Richard Roundtree played him, and Samuel L. Jackson, again, was in a reboot of the character in a 90s movie. Of course, you have Nyota Uhura from Star Wars: The Original Series, debuted way back in 1966, played by Nichelle Nichols. You have Morpheus from The Matrix in 1999, played by Lawrence Fishburne, or Larry Fishburne, as he's sometimes credited. The character is Zoe Washburn from 2002's series Firefly and subsequent movie Serenity, played by Gina Torres. Action Jackson from 1988, played by Carl Weathers.
Yeah.
And saving the best for last, because I know you want to comment on this one. 1988's Michael Jackson's Moonwalker.
I almost lumped that into my picks for obscure superhero film. Clearly, there's nothing obscure about Michael Jackson's pop culture presence or level of fame in any sense of the word.
Of course not.
But the... fantasy movie he made, which was probably mostly rightly criticized as a 2-hour just pat on the back for himself, collection of music videos, and there is a story narrative throughout, but it's not consistent. It kind of the movie element of it kind of picks up and drops off as they see fit. As a child, though, seeing that movie, it's the special effects and everything are on par with the movies of the time. I don't think it was ever released in America, in theaters, but you know, to watch that as a kid, especially as a kid who's a Michael Jackson fan, it definitely blows your mind, and it's definitely a creative, artistic experience.
Yeah, I definitely have to go back and find it and watch it. I think I may have seen it once as a kid. I didn't have any special connection to Michael Jackson when I was a kid, and so it never really built up. It doesn't have any special nostalgia for me, but I think it's probably definitely worth me going back and watching.
If for nothing else, then Joe Pesci's insanely over-the-top villain performance. That alone is just worth the price of admission in terms of entertainment value.
Hey, I'm sold. So, I mean, I think one of the more important ones on this list, you know, they're all important in their own way. Mace Windu, Shaft, of course, you know, Morpheus from The Matrix. Like I said, Zoe Washburn from Firefly is a good one. Action Jackson is pretty significant as a movie that's a starring vehicle for a black actor in 1988. So that was kind of a big deal. But I really think the most significant of this sort of, you know, non-comic book, non-superhero list is Uhura. From Star Trek. Again,
for sure.
Again, played by Nichelle Nichols. A lot of significant stuff happening with that character. Not only sort of her importance after she started in the series of recruiting diversity into NASA, you know, to really send people up into space, including recruiting Mae Jemison, who was an African-American astronaut, who later would appear on Star Trek. So she got to be in space both fictionally and for real. But of course, Uhura was also part of a really important moment in TV when her and Kirk kissed on the lips, which was pretty, you know, beyond the pale at the time.
Yeah, that was, that's still talked about as one of the most significant moments in television history, period, to this day. I guess you have, I think she has always given credit to Gene Roddenberry for that, that type of forward thinking and that type of, you know, seeing beyond classes or skin color or any kind of like discriminatory boundaries that existed then.
Well, definitely the utopic future that Star Trek represents would sort of, I mean, that just kind of stands to reason that that would be the exact, I mean, Kirk is making out and doing the dirty deed with green women and purple women and women right. with tentacles. There's no reason to think that he would be somehow against doing the deed with somebody of his own species. Regardless of melanin content.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's easy. Because that show is from the 60s, it's easy to forget how far in the future it's supposed to take place. And
something like 300 years.
Yeah, so by that point, of course, it would something as trivial as skin color wouldn't even be a consideration to the human race.
Well, science fiction has always been a sort of a ripe ground for sneaking diversity messages into the narratives. I mean, especially back in the 60s when, you know, there was really opposition to things like this. You could always tell the story through, you know, the story of, well, I mean, this was actually a Next Generation episode, I think. Or it might have been an original series episode. There was a species of alien where, you know, there were two subspecies on the same planet. One of them, half of the, you know, their right side was black and their left side was white.
Right.
And the other ones, their left side was white, or their right side was white and their left side was black. And so, of course, it's you know, the difference is just about left and right. It's not about white and black. You're both white and black, but the difference is left and right. But of course, the races didn't like each other. People could watch that and be like, "Wow, that's just silly. That's ridiculous. Of course, they shouldn't care about that." But they, you know, that was just an analogy for the real world and what was happening in our society at the time. And so finally, I think they just decided we're not going to try to tell this story or show this on screen through some sort of, you know, filter of science fiction. We're going to do it for real. And they kind of, you know, I don't know which versions of the story are true. You know, according to William Shatner and Uhura, they basically forced him into it by doing terrible takes where they didn't kiss. And then when their time was up, they basically did the kissing scene. It was the only take that was worth keeping. They were forced to use it.
Hey, that's you know, you resort to whatever you have to create history.
So I think that Uhura is definitely one of the more significant African-American characters in the history of sort of cinema / TV / media.
Pop culture, really, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to sum up her significance. So, yeah, I mean, that's basically the, you know, I mean, we could go a lot longer. We've gone long enough. But, I mean, that's what the Cliff's Notes version of the foundation of African-Americans in this sort of, well, like you said, in pop culture. Specifically, most of our conversation revolved around superhero movies, comic book movies, as sort of to set the foundation for what Black Panther represents, just to show that You know, the movie Black Panther is significant for a lot of reasons, but it doesn't exist in a vacuum. There's been a foundation. There's been a build-up to this moment, and those things deserve to be remembered and recognized for what they did represent in their time and now.
I just saw that one of the actors who played one of the half-black, half-white aliens in that episode of Star Trek called Let That Be Your Last Battlefield is Frank Gorshin, who, of course, was most famous for his role as the Riddler in the 60s Batman show.
Excellent.
He also, apparently, played the mobster Kingpin in Meteor Man.
I never would have known that. Very good. Wow. That's a nice bit of trivia.
I suppose that does it for our Black History Month rundown of all of the African-American starring vehicles and superhero and related media prior to the existence of Black Panther this year. I have been your friend Claude.
And I am Outsider Jamie.
And we will see you later.
Later.